Good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, or whatever it is, wherever you are. Thank you for tuning back in. This is Jeff Cherry, and you are listening to Capitalism the Remix. As you know, we've been off the air for a little bit. We're working on closing our second fund in May of this year, and believe it or not, after that, I got to take a little bit of time off and spent most of the summer working from the Adirondacks upstate New York and Saratoga Springs. So back in Baltimore and can't wait to get restarted with the stories of the next generation of capitalism. We've got a couple of previously recorded but unreleased episodes, and I can't wait for you to hear this next one, the first one, with my dear friend, mentor, colleague, partner, fellow chef, Ed Freeman, from the Darden School at the University of Virginia. If you've listened to me at all, read anything I've written over the years, you know how much Ed means to me, how much his thinking has influenced the work that we do. Ed is known as the father of stakeholder capitalism. He sometimes says he gets too much credit and too much blame, but based on his 1984 book, that really was the beginning of all of this strategic management, the stakeholder approach. I believe that Ed has set the foundation for all of us doing work to reimagine the way capitalism works in America. We're going to talk about everything on how someone who started his career studying philosophy has come to be known as one of the greatest management thinkers of our time. Through the how he understands that he's on the right path because he's pissing off both the left and the right politically. And then finally, we're going to talk a little bit about his new book, The Power of And, which really sets forth the path forward for a new narrative for capitalism and business in America. So I can't wait for you to hear this, for you to experience this discussion with my good friend, Ed Freeman. So let's get into it. We are Capitalism the Remix. So, Ed, thanks for joining. This is great. I know this is probably going to be out in a couple of weeks, but I'm going to see you in a couple of hours.
So, yeah, good.
It'll be good to catch up in person. It's been a while, so looking forward to it. But thanks for joining the show, Capitalism the Remix. I was lucky enough to be on your show not too long ago, and I re-listened to it, and I listened to Adrian's show too, which I thought was great, the interview you did with him just recently. So that's one thing we will definitely put in the show notes, a link to the stakeholder podcast. So, but to get started, you know, I was thinking about this last night. How did you end up at Duke? It feels like, I know we're going to get into the stakeholder stuff in a little bit, but it feels like Duke seems to me, when we talk about it, a long way from Columbus, Georgia.
It is a very long way. I took my daughters. I didn't actually grow up in Columbus. I grew up in a little one horse town about 35 miles from Columbus. Okay. Columbus was the only recognizable place. So it's a little place called Tobleton, Georgia. And I took my daughters down to visit, you know, graves and that sort of stuff. And one of them looked at me and said, "Dad, it's a long way from Tobleton, Georgia, where you are." You know, I didn't, my parents weren't well educated. My father dropped out of college after a year because he didn't want to do pre-med, which is what my grandparents wanted him to do. And my mother dropped out of high school to marry him. They got married at 17. I was the fourth child and they had me before they were 30. So I, you know, I'm in awe of how everybody survived in that.
Yeah.
But education was we were poor. We didn't have right. much. We weren't the poorest people around. The poorest people around, of course, were the African Americans in the town, which outnumbered the white, population, something like 3 or 4 to 1. It was a typical rural Georgia, you know, sort of thing. And education was the way out. And we all knew that. It's ironic. My brother, who passed away a long time ago, was a vet. Mm-hmm. And my two sisters and I are all professors.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, to Duke, I didn't know much. I had met somebody who'd been to Duke. I'd never been as far north as Durham, North Carolina. And, you know, and I didn't visit the study. You know, we didn't do college visits in those right. days. I don't know. I think it's just because I met some people I liked.
Yeah.
I'd done a summer as a high school math camp at Florida State. And I met some people that told me about Duke, and it sounded great, even though, honestly, I couldn't afford it.
Right.
So it was, I don't really know other than that. I know the basketball team was terrible when I was there.
They've gotten better.
Giving scholarships to, they're a little better now. They were giving scholarships to people I could take off the dribble. So, you know.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful place. I got a great education because not in math so much. I was math and philosophy.
Right.
But the philosophy department there had some really great inspirational teachers.
Yeah.
And I'm eternally grateful to the university and to the Duke philosophy department for that.
Yeah. Wow. So, I want to talk about, it's so fascinating because I think that you and I in some ways are very similar that way, so that came from families that didn't have much and ended up in education. I have three sisters, two of them are lawyers, you know, one's got a PhD in art therapy. And, you know, I know my dad maybe had 2 years of college and maybe the same for my mom, but we're surrounded by books. So it's really interesting. So,
yeah.
So you went all the way north to Durham, and then you ended up really north in Pennsylvania at Wharton. How did that happen?
Well, I'd gone to Washington University in St. Louis for grad school in philosophy, and that was just a matter of who gave me the best fellowship and had the best philosophy department. And WashU was the winner for me. It's where I met my wife, Maureen, and so when I'm finishing up, I was really young. I was maybe 23 or so, and guy on my committee said, you should go to, postdoc. And I didn't really know. There are no jobs in philosophy, but my sister had a postdoc at Hopkins, I think. And so I knew postdocs, you know, you got to check. And, I didn't particularly like being poor. And, who does? So he said, well, you should go to Pittsburgh, great philosophy department. I know people there, he said. He said, but you're interested in this decision-making and ethics stuff. You should go to Wharton. And honest to God, Jeff, I said, what's Wharton? I didn't have any idea. I mean, I'd never heard of it. But vaguely remembered one of my fraternity brothers had maybe was going to go there at some point in the future, but I didn't know what it was. And he said, it's a business school. And I kind of went, oh. I'm thinking this is like typing in shorthand. I don't really know what they do in business school, you know. Poor boy from Georgia farm, no idea about this. And then I said, where is it? And he said, well, University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. And I said, well, you know, I might be interested because Maureen, my girlfriend at the time, was going to city planning at Penn. And even though we had decided this wasn't serious, turned out it was serious. And so I show up at Wharton, get hired. I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing. And it was just one of those pure serendipity things. Right. You know, I went there for love or lust or whatever it was.
Or both.
Got there and... Now, my boss comes up to me. The stakeholder idea was kind of in the air.
Oh, yeah.
Russell Aikoff was there and other people. And my boss said to me one day, a man named Jim Imhoff, he said to me, you want to see what you can make of this stakeholder thing? No one's ever really done much with it other than kind of wave their hands about it. You know, what would companies be like if they really took it seriously? And I sort of took that as a challenge to do. I didn't realize it was going to be a kind of lifelong pursuit. Right. I thought it was going to be, well, I'll crank off a paper and then I'll get back to doing real philosophy. And it sort of acquired a life of its own.
Yeah, you were anticipating sort of my next question, because, you know, as you know, Ed, and as the folks that have been listening, you know, this whole thing, Capitalism the Remix, is about rethinking the way we think about business. And I tell people all the time, I didn't come to this. I mean, I saw a little bit of it happening in my, you know, when we were consulting and seeing people. But a lot of this I learned from you and from Raj, and, you know, sort of, but it was an organic thing, just like you said here. It was organic. We saw it happening. And, you know, I had been connected to David Wolf, Raj's co-author of Firms of Endearment. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I want to talk about that whole trajectory from the beginning, but maybe jump ahead a little bit. How did you meet sort of the rest of, you know, you or my, you know, conscious capitalism cabal, you know, Kip, yeah, and Tom Gardner and Raj, and how did you meet those guys?
Well, somebody said to me, you should pay, I don't remember who it was, said, you know, you should pay attention to Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. And so I logged onto the website, started reading John Mackey's blog. And it was sort of like he'd taken it right out of stuff I had written, or I could have written. And I mean, I didn't think he did anything. Yeah, sure. I just found myself, oh my God, this guy's actually, you know, doing stuff out there. So I wrote him a fan mail.
Oh, okay.
That said, hey, you've been out there doing this. I've been writing about it. You know, it's just really great to see some people out doing it. And he wrote me one back. He said, well, I read your book and, you know, all this stuff. So, you know, I think I met him at probably the first, when I met you at the CEO retreat. Yeah, right. And that's where I met Raj, and, you know, sort of started there. I had worked primarily, you know, with really big companies. I had spent my old 84 book is primarily about the Bell System. I disguised everything, but the Bell System is no more, so I can talk about it. I disguised all the projects, but I hadn't worked very much with startups, with people that sort of started thinking about creating value for stakeholders. I thought that's what they should do. Right. But I had worked primarily with big companies who had, as one of my academic colleagues, Ed Hartman, said, they started with the problem of roving gangs of stakeholders. You know, they had people trying to take them apart for some reason or other. And I thought, in those days, I thought I was a strategy guy.
Okay.
You know, this is how you think about business strategy. And while I still think that's true, how can I put this? No one in the strategy field agreed with me. I mean, literally no one. And so, so much for that. The only people that cared about this stuff were the people doing corporate social responsibility and business ethics and that sort of stuff. So I sort of started hanging out with them. And then meeting John and the conscious capitalism folks, the things started to come together in a pretty important way.
Yeah.
I had just tried to find different ways to say, look, business is about creating value for stakeholders. And the reason I said that was I didn't know it was supposed to be anything else. Yeah. You know, I never got immersed in this shareholder value thing. I, that seemed to me to be just dumb. You know, it didn't, I mean, I understood the economics of it and all of that, but when I looked around at companies and executives, that wasn't what they were doing,
right.
Even though they were calling it that. So again, it was a sort of, you know, long, strange trip.
Yeah.
To finally finding the tribe of people that's like, oh my God, these people, you know, are thinking about this pretty much the way I do, except they're smarter. They're out actually doing it.
Right. Well, you know, it's really interesting. A couple of things there. I on the cover notes for the podcast, I, you know, put something about finding our tribe. And our mutual friend, Rick Frazier, called me and said, hey, can you find another way to say that? Because let's try not to divide people. You know,
yeah.
And I know that's something you've been thinking about, let's stop talking about sinners and saints. Right. Which I think that we should, you know, move in that direction, but I'm telling you, you used to be the academic director of the Business Roundtable Institute for Corporate Ethics, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to get to this sort of thing. How did that come about? And then I want to talk about the Business Roundtable's message they put out in 2019.
2003, we started working, 2003, 2004, we started working with folks, John Castellani, who was the director of the roundtable, and his executive director. They wanted to do something with respect to ethics. This was, they're organized by committees, yeah. And this was the governance committee, chaired by Frank Raines,
yeah.
who had been head of OMB under Clinton. And the governance committee was tired of what I've called a business suck story, but I think they were really tired of getting tarred with the brush of scandal. You know, 2003, 2004 was kind of after Enron, yep, and WorldCom, right, and all that stuff. And so they start this, and we started it as a independent organization housed at Darden. And they funded it for a number of years, pretty much until, and our idea was to do seminars and studies and be a bridge between the academics who did business ethics and the folks at the round table. And so we did a lot of stuff. I think that was really good. We had a series of papers called Bridge Pay Papers, mm-hmm, where we would take the academic stuff and then write it so that normal people could read it,
right.
do it with the authors, so we didn't piss them off. We had all of the kind of who's who of business ethics were resources for this center. I forget what we called them. We couldn't call them faculty because their schools wouldn't let them do that. So, but they were signed up to do it. And Tom Donaldson at Wharton and I ran a lot of seminars for roundtable CEOs, and everything was fine. John Castellani left, and I thought the roundtable, I don't want to be too critical here, but I thought during the Obama administration, they paid too much attention to Obamacare and some of those things, and they wanted to turn us into a group that kind of did studies that helped them lobby what they wanted to do. And while we were willing to do that for some things that we believed, yeah, in, we wouldn't have kept our independence if that was what we had done. So we had a kind of parting of the ways. We didn't have a big, you know, round table ends its ethics, right, group or any of that sort of stuff. We just sort of gradually withered away. So I hadn't really had much to do with the roundtable since probably 2014. It was about a 10-year thing. And so imagine my surprise when I read the roundtable statement on stakeholder theory and purpose. I thought it was great. I mean, my fist was pumping in the air that they had done this, you know, and, you know, bloody about time. I mean, because we had talked to them about this for a long time. I don't know that we had any effect whatsoever. I don't know where that came from. It could have come from, you know, the World Economic Forum, who claimed to have invented stakeholder theory, even though they know they didn't. There's a lot of that going on. I've often said, you know, that I was the only person to have written about this idea who did not claim to have invented it. And I get way too much credit. That still makes me uncomfortable.
For those of you who haven't heard about the Business Roundtable statement, which is really important, Business Roundtable is an organization of the largest businesses, certainly in North America, biggest businesses, some of the biggest businesses in the world, excuse me. And they put out a statement in 2019, just before the pandemic. Companies should serve not only their shareholders, but also deliver value to their customers, invest in employees, deal fairly with suppliers, support the communities in which they operate. And, you know, when you hear that, sometimes it just sounds like common sense on its face. But the same as you, you know, people were texting me and, you know, these guys are, you know, are drinking your Kool-Aid, Jeff, and all that sort of stuff. And I the same time, so that was, it was September, I think. I don't remember the exact day, but it was July 2019. And when it came out, obviously it came out in the morning for the news cycle. And I called Rick, our mutual friend, Rick Frazier, who used to run a hedge fund, you know, based on your and Roger's thinking and still does. And I said, hey, what do you think? How long do you think it'll be before the Wall Street Journal puts out a counter statement or rebuttal? And he said, you know, Jeff, maybe a week. And then the first rebuttal I saw came out at 5:09 p.m. the same day in the Wall Street Journal.
The same day.
It was titled, "The Stakeholder CEOs, Executives Who Abandon Shareholders Want to Appease the Socialists." Right. So by saying that, yeah, hey, all you know, by trying to get away from the business sucks, and like you say, that business is all about employees, suppliers, communities, customers, and the people with the money. By saying that, all of a sudden, the Wall Street Journal says they're abandoning shareholders, right? And I think at 5:50, there was another one came out that says, big business and its stakeholders. The Business Roundtable commits to delivering value to people who don't own any shares. So,
see, the thing about this is, and a better bet would have been, how long would it take the people on the left to come out with a statement that this is a bad idea? That's probably more like the week. I don't know when the first New York Times thing came out, but I could have told people this because for the longest time, I have pissed off the left and the right. Yeah. The people on the right, of course, think I'm a socialist, and the people on the left think I've sold out to business.
Right. Exactly.
And of course, you can't sell out to these greedy little bastards who are trying to do each other in, the executives. And now, of course, I used to think I was kind of middle of the road. Now I don't know what that means. In today's political environment, those in the center just seem to adopt the worst ideas of both the left and the right. So I don't know.
That's how they're real.
I think what you said is right. This is common sense.
Yeah.
Businesses have always created value for their stakeholders. What else could they do? I mean, they may not understand that they have to create value for customers, but boy, if they do understand that, then they can improve it. They may not understand that communities are important. I think companies like Walmart got that lesson told to them in a hurry. And they understand that now, and they're again, they're improving the hell out of what they're doing. So I sort of, Maureen Wellen, my wife, when she read my old 84 book, she looked at me and said, well, you know, you're never going to make a living at this. This is just common sense. Now, she had been an MBA from Wharton. So I took that as high praise that this was common sense. You know, she claimed she never said you'll never make a living at this, but that's how I interpreted what she said.
When I see her this weekend, we'll see. I'll see what she has to say about that. But, you know, so it's so fascinating. So on one hand, I want to ask, why do you think, because you're right, I was thinking about this last night, that the other people who pushed back, Robert Reich and Elizabeth Warren, you know, they wanted to push back on the statement too. And I'm looking at that thing, you know, in some ways, you know, we also think that if the folks on the left and the folks on the right are both pissed off at you, you must be doing something right. You know?
And that's my view. One of my heroes, philosopher Richard Rorty, now passed away, but Dick said, look, you got enemies on the left and the right. Maybe you're doing something that's interesting. Right. And he had plenty of enemies on the left and the right. So I take that as a compliment.
Right.
And that's not how it's intended, I can assure you.
Right, for sure. Yeah, Rick and I would say, when we first, as you know, when we first started, the hedge fund used to say the same thing. On one side, they think we're a wolf in sheep's clothing. On the other side, they think we're socialists. And they can't figure out why we were making so much money. You know, doing either. So
I love that.
Trying to tell them, but you know, I think that. So the first what you were talking about. So your 84 book was stakeholder. Tell me the title. I had it written.
Strategic Management: A Stakeholder Approach. Horrible title. First in a series of horrible titles that I've done. It should have been called Stakeholder Management, a Strategic Approach. But I actually wrote it as a textbook for people teaching strategy.
Uh-huh.
That was a horrible idea. And I only tried to use it as a textbook in class once. And it has a lot of stuff in it that's interesting. It also has a lot of stuff in it that you'd never do in a classroom. Right. Because it's written primarily for academics, but for managers as well.
And then I think more recently, which I think, you know, as we all think these things through, think the narrative through and try to come to what's the best way to articulate this. I think, you know, I was going to say, let's talk about unavoidable trade-offs between acting ethically and being financially successful. Or in other words, let's talk about the power of and.
You
know, the more recent book.
Yeah.
Because I think that when if I'll have you describe the book, but I think that, you know, sort of the five sort of tenets or whatever you want to call them that you and Bobby Palmer put forth in that book really start to get to, you know, sort of the soul of what we're talking about. And I also think it's a way that, you know, we can bridge the divide between these tribes in some ways, if people think about it. Talk a little bit about sort of the power of Anne and what you guys were sort of thinking about there.
Well, you were there at the very beginning. You and I both went to this meeting at the White House, if you remember, and had everybody who had, you know, proposed reforms in capitalism, everybody from impact investors and ESG people to the people that had done conscious capitalism and inclusive capitalism and those kinds of things. And Tom Perez had called a meeting, as he was the labor secretary. So the waning days of the Obama administration, but you also got to remember, everybody thought they were going to get another four years. So that was the other piece of that.
Yeah.
And part of their question was, you know, what's the right, or all these reforms, what's the right brand? And I sat there with you, as a matter of fact, and I don't think that's the right question. I don't think it's what's the right brand. I think it's, can we agree on what the four or five things are that have to change? And so that's why I came back, and Bobby and Kirsten Martin, another former PhD student of mine who's a professor at Notre Dame, you know, we said, well, there are at least these five things. And it's wrong to think about you throw out the old story. You just need to retell it. So it's not just profits, it's purpose and profits. It's stakeholders and shareholders, even though shareholders are stakeholders, yeah, yeah. But most people don't know that. They just oppose them. It's seeing business as a societal institution and a market institution. It's seeing us as fully human and as economic creatures. And it's putting ethics and business together, not as a oxymoron, which is what the old story does. So, I mean, maybe there's some more ands. I'm sure there are. These were the five that we could identify that seemed to me that most of the cases for reform would agree on some version of that, and that's why we wrote it. Because it's too easy to take a sort of trade-off view. You know, economists love trade-offs. They can always find them. And they love trade-offs because they have a bunch of assumptions about the economy is always at equilibrium and people are always trying to maximize their short-term self-interest. There are people, as we both know, who try to maximize their short-term self-interest. We call them sociopaths. Right. And then usually we elect them to high office.
Put them in charge.
On both sides. That's nonpartisan. Yeah. Nonpartisan for me. But you know, we thought we just sort of stole this. I still feel bad that we didn't acknowledge it in the book. We just forgot. We kind of stole this idea from Jim Collins, who in one of his books writes about the tyranny of the or. Well, that's just the tyranny of trade-off thinking.
Right.
You may not find the sweet spot of an and, but if you don't look for it, you certainly are not going to find it. So I think Raj and John Mackey talked about win. Where you try to find wins for all the stakeholders. It's hard to do.
It's not easy, right?
And as I've said many times, one of the reasons it's hard to do is we don't think about creative imagination in education. We don't think about building people's creative muscle, which is incredibly important. If you don't build it, you lose it.
Yeah, look, I think that you've seen, and I certainly see now every day, the Conscious Venture Lab. I mean, I don't, you know, we talk about your book and your course, New Models of Business and Society, but we're constantly having this discussion with startups, with entrepreneurs, which is one reason why I remain optimistic, right?
Yeah,
because when we're talking to now. When, you know, now that we've gone hybrid, we're doing 30 companies at a time in the Conscious Venture Lab.
Yeah.
So when we're talking to them about purpose and profits, you know, don't forget that shareholders are stakeholders, but just one stakeholder, that business needs to be an instrument of society and of markets, that you have to care about what society cares about, that we are, as employees, suppliers, partners, we're both human and interested in our economics, right? And ethics and business. Entrepreneurs are like, yeah, that makes perfect
sense. They love that.
They love it. It makes perfect sense. And often what we hear is that we're not really sure how to integrate it. And I'm like, well, that's why we're here. We can bring people to help you do that. But we very, very rarely get pushback on any of those ideas when we're talking to, you know, young entrepreneurs who are starting up. They're idealistic. Yeah. They see a problem they want to solve. They usually don't just start the business because they only want to make money. Obviously, I'm a capitalist. I want people to make as much money as they possibly can. But I think But I think it matters how you make that money. And the other thing about it is, this is one thing, and I want to hear your thoughts on this. We've been starting to call this sort of the paradox of purpose, right? The minute you take the shareholder blinders off, you know, you have to sort of exercise your creativity in order to do that. But the minute you take your shareholder blinders off and start talking about some business as as a calling to do something greater than yourself, something interesting happens. Employees care more, suppliers care more, communities welcome you in, customers give you the benefit of the doubt, and oh, because of all that, you start to make more money. Right.
Yeah.
So it's just I'm often I just confused about the pushback we get.
Well, it's I mean, I find the same thing about pushback and the lack thereof. I mean, now part of it's that I've heard every possible criticism of this idea in the last 40 years. Yeah. So, you know. I think people don't bother me with stuff they know of, or they're afraid I'll write another paper right. saying why it's wrong. But I think that there's much more acceptance of the idea across all elements of society that that understand it. Aristotle understood this phenomena actually pretty well, because Aristotle understood that something like happiness was an outcome. So if you think about the people you know who are obsessed with being happy, everything they do, you know, they have to sort of build happiness into it, et cetera. Yeah. They're the most miserable people on the face of the earth because they don't understand right. that happiness is an outcome of what you're doing, what its meaning is, who you love, who your connections are with, etc. And then you have a rich, full life about that. And guess what? It turns out you're happy. Profitability kind of works the same way most of the time. Pay attention to creating value for customers, suppliers, employees, and community. And if you get lucky and have some good ideas, profitability is the outcome right. of that, you know, and that's the, we see it as an input measure, and that does some nasty stuff like the global financial crisis.
Yeah.
You know, people say to me all the time, you know, well, you know, can I be financially successful if I do this? Well, I mean, if you want to know, is that guaranteed? No.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you better buy a refrigerator you want to guarantee, or a puppy. Puppy will lick your hand, pretty much guaranteed. But, you know, is it possible? The answer is yeah. It's possible. That's been done. You and Rick did it, showed it.
Well, we were
lots of other studies yeah. have shown that it's. It's absolutely true.
We were fascinated by that as a question too, because when we started the hedge fund, well, if you know, can you be financially successful investing this way? And we're like, look at all the hedge funds that blow up every day that invest the other way. You're not asking them the same question. Why are you
right,
asking
exactly.
them that question? So right. That was always fascinating right. to me. What about? I mean,
the old story has the old story that business is about the money has a strong grip on us. It's got a grip on the institutions in society, and breaking that grip is going to take a couple of more generations, I think.
Yeah, I know that we've talked about that before in some of your classes about, you know, all the important things that we try to accomplish. They take a long time, right? Women's rights,
yeah.
You know, all the things that, you know, women getting the vote and, you know, equal rights and, you know, sort of how blacks are treated in society. All these things take a long time, right?
Yeah.
So this will probably be not unlike that as well. Speaking of Darden, I mean, you get some of the smartest students in the world coming through there. How I'm imagining, I've seen some of it, but how is this being received at, you know, at the institution level at a place like Darden?
Well, I think whether we want to be or not, we're kind of known as the ethics and stakeholder school, you know, and I think that's because we've been pretty persistent in the last 35 years about that stuff's important. And we've had deans who have supported faculty members like me. We've got other faculty members who you know, write about stakeholder theory or do stuff like Gene Lichter's work on design thinking, yeah, which the stakeholder idea is in part, or Sarasvati's work on entrepreneurship, of which stakeholder theory is a part. And so, you know, the students get it in lots of places.
Yeah.
You just couldn't graduate here without, well, in part because ethics is a required course. You couldn't graduate here without knowing something about stakeholder theory. And you've seen that, we've seen the change from people that would argue, no, that's a waste of time, you only need to focus on shareholders, to people who realize, well, even if I really in my heart believe that shareholders own the company, I still got to deal with these other groups because they're a part to creating value. And I'm fine with the folks who, you know, if that's the way they want to be, fine. As long as they're trying to create value for other stakeholders, they're going to be good.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I think it's also true, it's become more, well, let me put it this way. During the pandemic, I spoke via Zoom at probably 50 universities all over the world. And I kind of gave pretty much the same talk on the power of and. And so I think the ideas are, you know, people are starting, they're starting to hum the tune.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm hoping that you're right. I think that you're right. It's certainly from our perspective, you know, we're seeing it every day with more and more entrepreneurs. I can tell you that, you know, we're getting better, more accomplished, more successful entrepreneurs in every cohort of the Conscious Venture Lab, and they're all sort of trying to embracing this. So, look, I think that
I can tell that just in my brief work with them, I can tell they really have grown since that first cohort.
Yeah. Eight, you know, we're in number eight. And, you know, as for those of you who don't know, also thank you to Ed, because Ed helped me sort of think through, you know, the curriculum for the Conscious Venture Lab and how we're going to do this. And we've evolved with Ed and Raj over the years, but it's been, you know, this is, if you're listening to this one, this is a good one to listen to a few times, because Ed's work and the discussions that he and I have had over the years is really foundational to the ideas that we're trying to bring, you know, that we're talking about here at remixing, rethinking. I love this idea. This is why, you know, I didn't know this when I first came up with the name, but remixing is better than replacing, right? As you said, we're not trying to replace.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I wish I'd thought about that as a title. I would have stolen it for it would have been Remixing Capitalism, the Power of And,
or something like that.
Because as a musician, I know what remixes can do.
Right, exactly.
And boy, they can make you sound much better than the second time.
The music part was why I came up with that. And speaking of the music part, first of all, thanks, Ed, for taking the time. It's always great to see you. And Molly and I are thrilled to be hopping on the train and coming down to see you later on today.
Yep, looking forward to it.
But speaking of music, usually at the end of this, and I ask one question, but I'm going to ask two. Usually I ask, what's going on for you that those of us listening, those people who are tuning in, what can they do to be helpful to you, right? What do you need? What's going on in the world? So I want you to think about that. Why don't we start with that, and then we'll go to the next question.
Okay. Well, I think just be aware when you get caught in the grip of the old story. Be aware when you want to say, oh, business is just about the money, or you want to do something that means that's because it's not. And so trying to figure out how the old story that business is just about the money, how it plays into everything from TV shows where executives are greedy little bastards to what you might read in newspapers on both the left and the right.
Yep.
And, you know, business is an institution about hope and possibility. And we have to be the generations that continue to create hope and possibility for people. And I'm as optimistic as you are, Jeff. I think that's on the way, and there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Thanks for that, Ed. And people are going to really respond to that and resonate with that, the hope part of this, because that's what it's all about. All right. So to end this, I'm going to turn the tables on you. Now, I want to know if you are stuck on the stuck on a desert island. What are the three? I'll let you choose. It could be three songs or three albums that you absolutely must have with you. You can't. For those of you who don't know, Ed ends his podcast like this, and it puts us all.
Except I give people five.
Oh, you got five. I'll give you five. That's all right. I'll give you five.
All right.
I'll give
good.
You five. Five, right. And you can choose songs or albums.
I'll do albums. All right. Number one, Allman Brothers Live at Fillmore East.
All right.
Best live out, the remix version. The best live rock and roll album ever done.
All right, that's a good one.
Number two, B.B. King Live at the Regal. The best live blues album ever done.
All right.
Number three, Yo-Yo Ma. Cello concerto, Bach cello concerto. Quite possibly the most beautiful piece of music I've ever heard.
So far, you're three for three in my book. Yeah.
Number four, Something by Bob Marley. You can use Legends.
Yeah.
But there's probably another Marley record that might be better. Legends is a good, I would be happy with that. The Legends that has the right version of Buffalo Soldier. There are two versions of it. One is a kind of, straight ahead rock version, and one is kind of a slower version. The fast version's better.
Okay.
And fifth, Kind of Blue
kind
by
of
Miles.
Blue. All right. You heard it here first. Those five will definitely be in the show notes. So you can do your own Ed Freeman playlist, along with links to both of Ed's books that we talked about here. There's probably some other stuff we'll put in there with respect to things going on in Darden and lots of things that we got going on in the world. Ed, always a pleasure, my man. This has been really fantastic. That time went by like nothing. So thanks for joining. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure. Pleasure for me too, Jeff. I look forward to seeing you this evening.
All right, we'll talk soon.
Wow. As always, Ed delivers. Ed delivers. I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. I always love spending time with Ed, talking about the things that he and I are so passionate about. So check the show notes. We'll have links in there to Ed's book, to Ed's bio, anything you want to or need to know. And until next time, we are Capitalism, the Remix. See you soon. Bye.